Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club's Voices of Reform series, which addresses issues surrounding California governance reform. It's made possible by generous support from the James Irvine Foundation. My name is Bob Saldick. I am a member of the Commonwealth Club's Board of Governors and your chair for today. We welcome our listeners on the radio as well as our folks here in San Francisco's office of the Commonwealth Club. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. David Osborne is the author of, or co-author of, five books, most recently, The Price of Government, Getting the Results We Need in an Age of Permanent Fiscal Crisis. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? Mr. Osborne is a senior partner of the Public Strategies Group, a consulting firm that helps public organizations develop and implement strategies to improve their performance. In 1993, he served as senior advisor to Vice President Gore to help what the vice president often called his Reinventing Government Task Force, the National Performance Review. He was the chief author of the National Performance Review report, called by Time Magazine the most readable federal document in memory. He also serves as a fellow of the National Academy of Public Administration, a congressionally chartered organization similar to the National Academy of Sciences. He is a fellow of the Progressive Policy Institute, which is the think tank of the Democratic Leadership Council. Mr. Osborne graduated with honors from Stanford University. He has taught at Yale as a visiting lecturer. He and his children live in Essex, Massachusetts, northeast of Boston. And he tells me that his mother has informed him that being invited to the Commonwealth Club is as good as it gets. So with great pleasure, I introduce to you David Osborne.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank the Commonwealth Club for the honor of this invitation. My mother really does tell me that I've made it, if I've made it to the Commonwealth Club. It's always wonderful for me to be in San Francisco. I grew up mostly in San Jose. I went to Stanford, and then I moved to San Francisco, lived here for about 5 years. And I had married a New England girl who got into medical school in New York and not in San Francisco. So in 1978, we left. But I still feel more at home in this city than any place on earth. So it's great to be back. I used to work a block from here back in the 70s. I used to park my old VW Bug in the huge parking lot, which is now the Moscone Center. And I'll tell you, south of Market was different in those days. That experience of leaving California in 1978 and moving to New York and then spending a lot of time in Washington as a freelance journalist shaped what I've written about in fundamental ways, because here in California, I'd lived through Ronald Reagan's governorship, I knew how slick he was, and I'd watched Proposition 13 build and pass, and then when we moved east, you know, 6 months later, the same kind of proposition passed in about a dozen other states, and I could see tax cut fever sweeping America. And it just seemed logical to me with Jimmy Carter failing as president, Ronald Reagan was going to be our next president. Well, when I told people that in New York and Washington, they would look at me like I was the village idiot. Ronald Reagan, he's a B-grade actor from Hollywood. People like that don't get to be president. So I learned a very fundamental lesson, which is if you want to know where American politics and government is going, stay out of Washington and look at the states and the local level, because that's where it all comes from. How many of you remember when Ronald Reagan was elected president? Yep, most of you. There's a few folks in here who are too young, but most of us remember it was 24 years ago. 24 years is not that long a time. You know, it's a long time, but it's not this abstraction. If we go forward 24 years, we're talking about something that most of us are going to experience. So I want to take you forward 24 years and show you what happens to the federal budget if current trends continue. The Congressional Budget Office issued a study last December in which they had about three scenarios, and the most reasonable one is the one you can see on this chart. It assumes that healthcare inflation slows a little bit and the economy grows quite well. So it has pretty optimistic assumptions, and yet it says that in 24 years, we're going to be able to afford four things in the federal budget: Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and interest on the debt. Interest is not on this chart, but if you add it up, you hit the average federal revenue, which is close to 20% of GDP, in about 24 years with those four things. The big one, as you can see, is Medicare. It's a cost explosion. And the really severe problems begin in about 7 years when the baby boomers begin to retire, which is why George Bush, when he introduced his last budget, no longer projected revenues and spending and deficits for 10 years, as we've done for decades, but only for 5 years, because he didn't want you to see the second 5 years. It's a fiscal train wreck, and it is going to happen in one way or another. And everybody in Washington knows this. This study got publicity. David Walker, the Comptroller General of the United States, who runs the GAO, talks about nothing but this. And he says this study's wildly optimistic. He says it's much worse than this. There's a few senators who talk about it. Joe Lieberman and John McCain have talked about it. But most of Washington is ignoring it. And as a result, most of the media is ignoring it, which all proves to me that my favorite definition of Washington, D.C. still holds: 68 square miles bounded by reality. There's a great line from Mark Twain, too. He once said that in Washington, they consider the truth a precious commodity, so they ration it. Now, I know in California, things are a little different because, you know, it's illegal for governments here to borrow to cover operating costs, right? Now, how many of you voted for those illegal bonds? Fess up. My message today, my first message, and the first message in this book, is that this fiscal crisis we're enduring is not going away. It's permanent. It'll get a little better as the economy comes back. It's easing up a little. But we're never, in most places, going to get back to flush times, the kind of times we had in the 90s. That's the bad news. The good news is there are a lot of reforms that we can make that have been developed over the last 10 to 15 years and tried in a lot of places in this country and around the world that work, that aren't rocket science, and that we can all do to get more for less out of our taxpayers' dollars and deal with this crisis. And that's what I want to talk about today. But first, I want to make sure that I convince you that the problem is real and this fiscal crisis is permanent. You all have lived through it in California. You know how bad it is in California. But you may feel like you're unique in some ways. I find in most places in the country, they think they're unique. Well, you're not unique. This chart shows you that in every other fiscal crisis since World War II, we've bounced back. This is cumulative surpluses or deficits for local and state governments in the United States. You know, we've run into a bit of a deficit situation and then we've bounced right back. In this fiscal crisis, we fell off a cliff. We fell off a cliff. And I would argue that the first part of that, the sort of normal part of that plunge, was the economy. You know, it's tax receipts going south. But the abnormal part of that plunge is on the cost side, and that's what people don't understand. Costs. We have several just inexorable cost drivers that make this crisis permanent. The biggest one is the cost of health care. It's been going up 10% a year since at least 1970. That's on average. Some years it's more, some it's less. It is going to continue to go up 10% a year as far as we can see. And today, it is such a large portion of the federal budget and state budgets that 10% cost inflation is killing us. It's 30% of the average state budget, for example. That's Medicaid, health health insurance for state employees, and programs beyond Medicaid for the poor. Now, when 30% of your budget is going up 10% a year, you do the math, you need revenues going up pretty fast. On top of that, you've got the aging of the population. The average age is now pushing 80, which means lots of people are living to be 85 and 90. And two things happen when you live that long. One, you collect Social Security for a long time, and if you're a former civil servant, you collect a pension for a long time. So pension costs and Social Security costs are going up and up and up. And two, if you live that long, toward the end, you tend to consume an enormous amount of health care. As your systems decline and your organs fail, we just spend a vast amount of money on you in this country. So it's as if these two storms are coming together, the cost of health care and the aging of the population, and they're creating a cost explosion. And that cost explosion is most visible in Medicare, which is why Medicare is the 800-pound gorilla in the federal budget. We all think it's Social Security because that's what the media and the politicians have been talking about. It's not. It's Medicare. Finally, you've got interest on debt. Politicians have been doing their best to avoid this problem, and one of their techniques, as you know, is to borrow. And when you borrow, you have to pay interest on the debt. And I have bad news for you in California. The only other state I'm aware of that's been as irresponsible with borrowing as California was New York back in the 1970s, when New York City almost went bankrupt. The state floated bonds to bail them out, and the bad news is the taxpayers there have been paying interest on those bonds ever since, and the state has never been able to afford to pay them off. They refinanced them recently. So you're going to be paying the piper for years. Now, on the revenue side, there are problems also, but they're not as bad, and they're problems we can probably fix and we'll probably be forced to fix. But just in a nutshell, we're still taxing an industrial-era economy. In most states, the sales tax is only on goods, not services. In 1960, when 60% of transactions were for goods, that was a minor problem. Today, when 60% of transactions are for services, it's an increasing problem because we're letting the economy run away from our tax system. And on the goods side, we can't tax most internet transactions because of what Congress and the Supreme Court have done. So we're getting less and less of economic transactions. And in the global marketplace, big corporations with sophisticated accounting departments can increasingly move their profits offshore and escape taxation. So corporate taxes as a share of state revenues are down to 6%. Now, as I said, we're going to have to fix that stuff. I mean, we're going to be forced to tax services, I believe, and to tax internet transactions. But the bad news there is that citizens, as you know, are fairly resistant to tax increases, and they tend to put a ceiling on what we can do on the revenue side. We called our book The Price of Government because what we mean by the price of government is the percentage of personal income that goes to government through taxes, fees, and charges, the percentage of all our income that we devote to the public sector. And since 1950, that percentage has averaged 36 cents on the dollar. And it's kind of like a thermostat that tends to stay within the band of 35 to 37 cents. You can see American history in this graph. You can see that in the 1950s, the Republicans kept trying to push taxes back down and get that price of government down, and we kept having recessions as a result. And in the 1960s, it kind of leveled off at about 36 cents on the dollar. And then Lyndon Johnson tried to have a great society and fight the Vietnam War at the same time, and it went up to historically high levels of 39 cents on the dollar. After the war, it came back down to about 37. We had a little tax revolt around in the late 70s and early 80s, and it went down for a few years and then back up. And then in the 90s, President Clinton and the Democrats in Congress increased taxes on the wealthy to deal with the deficit and raised the gas tax by 4.5 cents and controlled spending along with the Republicans in Congress, and gradually we got out of the deficit into surplus and ran a large enough surplus that we were up to 39 cents on the dollar. So in 2000, Al Gore said he wanted to cut taxes by $500 to $600 billion, and George Bush said $1.3 trillion. So everybody knew that the American people needed some tax relief. If you break it down, the second line is federal, and you can see most of the variation is really in the federal government. State and local prices of government are pretty steady. At the state level, it tends to be about 7.3 to 8.3 cents on the dollar. That's the thermostatic range. At the local level, it's about 6 to 6.6 cents on the dollar on average. And if you look more closely at the local and state level, you can see that state government has just been trending up. This is since 1972. It's been trending up for 30 years. The reason is simple. 90% of what state governments do is three things. They educate, they medicate, and they incarcerate. In all three of those things, we've been spending more money. At the local level, you can dramatically see the tax revolt, where the price of government went down in the late 70s and early 80s. But the problem is, as you remember, services declined. And pretty soon the public began demanding that they be improved, and it went right back up to the historic level. California, you all remember. I mean, California's curve or graph is classic. Californians are comfortable spending 15 cents on the dollar for their state and local governments. That's what they were doing in the 70s. And then we had this rapid housing inflation, which drove people's property taxes up sharply, which triggered a tax revolt, and Howard Jarvis and Paul Gann captured it. Prop 13 passed, and the price suddenly plunged to about 12.5 cents on the dollar. And those of you who remember that era remember that highways and roads started to decline, and schools started to decline, and crime went up, and you know, the public sector frayed at the edges. So what did the voters do? In thousands of different decisions at election time, they pushed for better services. And the price gradually rose right back up to 15 cents on the dollar to the national average, where it stayed through most of the 90s. Right now, it's just a tad above, or the latest data we have from the Census Bureau is 2000. And in 2000, it was just a tad above the national average. It's like a thermostat. The citizens have been telling us for years how much they're willing to spend. And when the elected officials spend more than that, there's a reaction. And when they spend less than that, there's a reaction. So the price of government, at least in this historical era, is fairly set. And that's the problem. The costs, we've got several fundamental cost drivers that are just going to keep going up, and we've got a kind of revenue level that's going to be pretty steady. And that's why I argue that this fiscal crisis is not going away. Now, as I said, the good news is there's lots we can do about this. In the book, we talk about smarter budgeting, smarter sizing, smarter spending, smarter management, and smarter leadership. And I want to talk mostly this morning about smarter budgeting, because how many of you work in the public sector? Raise your hands if you work in the public sector. Well, those of you who do know that the budget system is the most powerful driver of behavior in government. How you get your money and how much you get and when you get it and with what strings attached and what incentives is so powerful. And if you can change it, you can change a lot. So let's talk about how it works right now. Traditional budgeting is based on costs. It's cost-based budgeting. And what happens is the budget office sends out instructions asking for budget submissions, and all the departments and agencies work up their budget submissions. What they do is they take last year's costs for granted, they add inflation, and they add caseload increases. You know, more people on welfare or unemployment insurance or more kids in school. And you get a new base, and that's your base. And it might be 5% higher than last year, but if they cut it by 3%, you scream because you've been cut, even though you got 2% more than you got last year. And when you submit a budget, what you're doing is submitting your costs and justifying them. And if you're smart, you add in some padding. You hide some extra because you know you're going to get cut. And if you're a good manager, you want to be able to function well after the cuts. So you got to get some padding in there to protect yourself. So your incentive is very clear. Whoops. Your incentive is to build up your costs and to make it very hard to cut your spending, cut your budget. And there's all kinds of games people play. You know, in Washington, it's the Washington Monument game. You know, if you're the Park Service, you say, okay, cut our budget. We'll just close the Washington Monument. I was in San Jose yesterday, and they told me that in this last budget cycle there, it was the Parks and Recs Department saying, okay, we'll have to close the restrooms in the parks. You know, there's lots of ways to make it hard to cut your budget. And, you know, in this whole process, the budget analyst's job is to find those ways. It's a game of hide and seek. And it's all based on the assumption that you can't trust anything. Nobody's telling the truth. So it's lots of fun. But the worst place to sit in a fiscal crisis is in the chair of an elected official, because your job ultimately is to cut services and or raise taxes and get the blame for both. But what's really important is that all the debate focuses on is cuts and tax increases. Budget season is a black hole of energy. You would not believe the amount of time and energy that goes into it. And 99% of it focuses on cuts and taxing and fee increases. And maybe 1% of the energy focuses on, okay, how are we going to take the 90% we're still going to spend and make it work better? And the fundamental decisions that get made after you've cut everybody across the board and weakened every program equally, you know, regardless of whether it's any good, then when it gets time to make the toughest cuts, the calculus is political. Behind closed doors, legislators are thinking, how can I give my constituents and interest groups the least pain before the next election? Which is democracy, and it's fine, but it's very short-sighted. And it means we make really irrational decisions. Those with the least political power, who can inflict the least pain at election time, lose out. They get the short end of the stick time after time after time. And as I said, all the energy is spent on the cuts, not on what you're going to keep, not on how to make what you're going to spend work better. Now, if we keep doing it that way, we'll just get the same results. One of my favorite things Bill Clinton used to say during the 1992 campaign, is he used to say, you know, my wife Hillary read this book about insanity, and she says the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting the same result. If we budget the same way over and over again, we're going to keep getting the same results. So my co-author, Peter Hutchinson, who's president of our company, is a former finance commissioner in the state of Minnesota. And during the last fiscal crisis, he was trying to figure out a new way to budget and developing some new ideas. And then his governor, Rudy Perpich, had the temerity to lose the election in 1990. So instead of reinventing the budget process, he founded the Public Strategies Group. And he's been looking for somebody ever since who would take his ideas. And 12 years later, he found one. Governor Gary Locke in Washington State. Peter and the rest of us developed something we call budgeting for outcomes, which is a new budget game. And it worked dramatically in Washington. It's spreading rapidly. Mayor Jim Hahn has done it in Los Angeles. The city of Azusa has done it. Spokane, Washington, we're now working with. A couple of counties in Washington. The governor of Iowa, Tom Vilsack, who incidentally is a terrific guy who's on John Kerry's shortlist for vice president, is beginning the process. And we've even gotten a call from the premier of Ontario. So, you know, the politicians are desperate, and this is something that makes a huge difference. It is the single most powerful tool I've ever seen to deal with fiscal problems. And California ought to do it. The governor ought to develop his next budget this way, and San Francisco ought to do it. I've talked with your mayor about it. and I'm hoping he will be interested. But I want to tell you about it, and I want to give you a concrete example. I want to use Washington State as an example because it's much easier to understand if you've got a concrete example. So Washington was like California. It had a huge deficit, close to 15% of its budget. This was 2 years ago, fall of 2002. Gary Locke had been governor for 6 years. He had used all the tricks. You know, he'd done the accounting tricks and the, robbed one account to pay another, robbed Peter to pay Paul. He'd used, we call them the seven deadly deceptions. He'd used most of them. And he'd done across-the-board cuts. And he'd laid off several thousand state employees. And he still had a huge deficit. And he was sick of it. He wanted something different. So we were lucky enough to be able to pitch to him budgeting for outcomes. And what we said was, you should forget last year's costs for now. Don't start there. Don't assume them. Start by figuring out how much you've got to spend. And the citizens in Washington helped out a lot, because right in the middle of this, they defeated a tax increase on the, a referendum to increase the sales tax to pay for transportation by a margin of 70-30. So everyone in the state knew tax increases were not going to be part of the solution. Even though the governor would have liked them to be, it wasn't going to happen. So they did the revenue projection, said that's what we've got, that's going to be our price of government. So the next question is, what do the citizens of Washington want? What are the outcomes that are most important to them? And then how much are we going to spend on each outcome? And then how are we going to deliver that outcome? So they put together some teams to do this work. And the first step they took was to define these outcomes, the priorities of government, as the governor called them. And they came up with 10 things, which are kind of like mom and apple pie. It wouldn't be very different in California. Improving K-12 education, improving the workforce, improving the higher education, improving health, improving the condition of vulnerable children and adults, improving economic vitality, mobility, public safety, natural resources, and finally, cultural and recreational opportunities. Once they defined those 10, Peter said to them, all right, now you've got this much money. Let's carve it up into those 10 pots. Let's figure out the priorities. How much is K-12 education worth compared to public safety, compared to mobility? And the people we were dealing with just went nuts. We can't do that. I mean, that's not scientific. Peter said, you're right. It's not scientific. It's a value judgment. And it's just a starting point. We can adjust it later, but we need a starting point. And they said, well, what was it last year? And Peter said, no one knows. You've never measured it this way. So he finally cajoled them into doing this, and they came up without too much trouble with some numbers. They decided that the most important thing was improving K-12 education, and 29% of the money ought to go there. And then 6.5% for workforce and 9% for higher ed and 11% for health and so on. Then we asked them to, they created 10 teams, one for each outcome. And their job was to be sort of buying agents for the citizens, to act in the interest of the citizens and purchase results. They were from agencies, a scattering of people who had a lot of policy expertise, but the governor said, take off your agency hat and put on the citizen's hat. They had to define 3 indicators to measure progress against this outcome. Then, the most important step, they had to figure out what really affects this outcome. What are the most important factors? And they had to draw a strategy map of those factors and how they interrelate. So the healthcare team, for instance, looked at it, did all its work, and figured out that there were 4 really big drivers that affect health. There's, of course, access to health care, which is where we put most of the money. But there's also environmental hazards, which affect health. There's personal behavior. Do you drink? Do you smoke? What's your diet like? Do you get exercise? So on and so forth. And finally, there's genetic risk factors. And you can intervene on all four. And they looked at all the research and said, you know, even though all the money's in health care, the return on investment is in prevention. It's in changing personal behavior and mitigating environmental risk factors. So they decided to do something that I don't know that any other state has done in this crisis, which is completely protect the prevention stuff, the public health stuff, and make their cuts just in health care. It was painful. They recommended that 59,000 adults be removed. These are single working adults without children, be removed from a state health plan. But in my state, in Massachusetts, we did what the political logic suggests. We had the best anti-smoking campaign in the country, for example, according to the academics, and we gutted it immediately. It's gone, because that didn't cause any political pain. You know, there wasn't a constituency that was going to revolt. But in terms of results and health long-term, it was a stupid thing to do. So these teams came up with their basic purchasing plans, the basic strategies that were most important. And then we asked them, in Washington State, they took all of the state programs and divided them up according to these results teams and asked them to prioritize them. Now, ideally, if you had enough time and you were bold enough, you would actually ask for bids from not only your own agencies, but from nonprofits and for-profits and local governments and unions and anybody who wanted to make an offer. You would say, here are the results we want. Here are the strategies we want to fund. Tell us how you could deliver on those strategies, what results you could produce, and what price. And then you put it all together. And these, as I said, the offers would come from all over the place, and they would be in terms of what result you could produce at what price. And you put it all together, and then each team prioritizes. So in Washington State, they were just working with last year's programs and any new initiatives the teams came up with, and they had to rank them from most effective at producing the result to least effective. And then take the money they had, go down the list, and start buying until they run out. Draw a line, and the stuff below the line, they recommended it no longer be funded. Now, they made some adjustments, and they went through a guidance team and to the governor, and they made adjustments. You know, the governor's obviously got to make some political calculations here. There are some things that, you know, you might want to eliminate, but it's a pet project of the majority leader in the Senate, and of course, so you don't. But by and large, he adopted what these teams suggested. And the process had led to some decisions that were just very different than usual. Just one example, in education, the voters had voted for two referenda in recent years, one to raise teacher salaries and one to lower class sizes. And all the data says neither of those has any impact on student achievement. So the team recommended that they be suspended, which the legislature can do in Washington. And the governor recommended it, something no other governor in America would do, to recommend suspending voter initiatives that had passed. 20,000 teachers landed on the state house lawn to protest, and the legislature went along with the governor because those teachers had to argue that their salary increases would produce better results than the stuff that was being funded. And this budget was real simple. You could see one page for each result with what's going to be funded and what's not going to be funded. And so you could see the general interest. And it was an argument the teachers couldn't win. 97% of the budget passed. It was very successful. It produced a balanced budget without gimmicks. It got them focusing all their energy on the keeps, not the cuts, on how to produce the value that citizens wanted with the money they had. It created enormous accountability for performance, because if your program couldn't demonstrate that it was going to produce results at a good price, it likely didn't get funded. So there were real consequences. And believe me, these agencies are taking it very seriously the second time around as they prepare the next budget submissions. It created impetus for continuous reform and improvement. And finally, it allowed the politicians to talk in very common sense terms to the public. The media loved this budget. It had horrendous cuts in it. As Joe Deere, a former chief of staff to the governor, said, never has such bad news been received so well. They loved it because, one, it was the first state budget they'd ever been able to understand. And two, you know, the governor said, I'm not going to thin the soup. We're going to choose our priorities based on the results that are important to citizens. And if something is a priority, we're going to fund it well. And if it's not, if it isn't effective at delivering these results, we're not going to be able to afford to do it any longer. It's time to make some choices. And that's what people want from their leaders. They want people who will make tough decisions. So politically, it was a home run for the governor. Now, once you do all this, of course, your managers then have to do all kinds of other things to deliver more for less, because they've often got less money and more pressure. And I've written about a lot of this for years, but just to touch on a few, one of the most powerful things they can use is competition. All over the world, when agencies have bid out services and let the private sector bid against the public sector, public agencies often win, but the savings, the average savings, is about 25% the first time you do it. So the average agency seems to be able, when faced with a hanging, to figure out almost overnight how to cut its costs by 25%. It's politically tough, but it works. Performance management is another obvious solution. You measure results, you give feedback. Things like CompStat in the New York Police Department, which Baltimore has done citywide, they call it CityStat, are increasingly effective, and every city and state ought to use them. There's a lot of ways to empower customers and save money at the same time. For example, I just renewed my driver's license. You know what that's like. But this time, I got to do it online. It took 2 minutes. I was overjoyed. And the state of Massachusetts saved 76% on the transaction. Huge savings. Then you also have to change your management systems. You know, one of the big problems in the public sector is that every time something goes wrong, we pass a new rule, and we basically tie all the managers and employees up in so much red tape that it's impossible to improve. So you have to untie the red tape. You have to give agencies flexibility. You have to change your budget, personnel, and purchasing systems, and auditing and accounting systems, so that, in fact, managers have the power to manage. They have the power to hire, fire, reward, promote, incentivize. They have the power to move money around within their budget to do what they need to do to improve results. They have the power to purchase what they need when they need it. And believe me, most public managers have none of that power. Now, there's a lot more in the book, but I don't have time to go into it. I just want to close with a comment about what's at stake in all this. I'm a big fan of Native American philosophies, and one of my favorite sayings is that when you're riding a dead horse, the best strategy is to dismount. And folks, the horse of industrial-era bureaucracy is dead. The history of government in this country in the 20th century is a history of great success. Our top-down, centralized, industrial-era bureaucracies did a good job for us, but the world changed. We live in the information age, and the environment is very different. And those institutions are increasingly dysfunctional. So we have to reinvent them for the information age. The stakes are very, very high. So much hangs in the balance. You know, whether kids can get the kind of education they need to lead a productive life, whether there's crime in the streets, whether the air you breathe is clean, whether the water you drink is clean, on, and whether you can get access to health care, on and on and on. There's an enormous amount at stake. So whether you're a conservative who wants taxes down, or a moderate who likes taxes where they are but wants more value, or a liberal who wants us to be able to do things like funding universal health reform, this fiscal crisis is permanent, and the only way through is fundamental reinvention. Thank you very much.
Our thanks to David Osborne, senior partner of the Public Strategies Group and former advisor to Vice President Al Gore, and co-author of Reinventing Government and his new book, The Price of Government, for his comments today. My name is John Elwood. I'm a professor at the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley, and it's my pleasure to moderate today's audience question period. And as you know, folks have been passing up the questions, and I've done my best to group them into piles here. And the first question, I'm trying to do many at the same time, is I'd like Mr. Osborne to comment on three or four governors, because a number of the questions deal with different governors. One question posits that after implementing his new budget process, Governor Locke of Washington was so unpopular that he decided not to run for re-election. In addition, on the other hand, we have the governor of California, Governor Schwarzenegger, who is now at an all-time high, according to the field poll, in terms of California governors, having proposed a budget which basically is based on five of the deadly seven sins outlined in Professor Osborne's book, full of accounting gimmicks, robbing Peter to pay Paul.
More borrowing.
You know, all that sort of stuff. And finally, there's the governor of Virginia, who has gone the other way from Governor Locke and built a coalition with a Republican legislature to increase taxes. And so how would you evaluate these three governors?
Okay, let's take Governor Locke first. He had been in office for 6 years when he did this. He chose not to run for a third term, which surprised a lot of people. This process, this budget process, had a very healthy impact on his popularity. There was a poll done a month after he released his budget, which asked basically do you agree with the following statement? Whether I agree or not with all of the governor's budget decisions and cuts, I think he has demonstrated real leadership in leading Washington through this crisis. And it was about 67% who agreed with that statement. And the interesting thing is that Gary Locke had a reputation as a technocrat, not a leader. His Republican opponent, when he ran for re-elections, main theme was the governor is not a leader. So he wasn't that popular. He didn't have a very good image. And this process helped his image enormously. Now, when you're cutting $2.5 billion and throwing people off of health care and denying teachers their salary increases that they expected and denying parents the lower class sizes that they expected, you're not going to get wildly popular. But his popularity, his approval rating, did not fall because of this. And there's a very interesting thing that happened. I told you that his tax increase, which he pushed personally onto the ballot, lost in November of 2002 by a 70-30 margin. It was a penny sales tax increase devoted to transportation. So he finally gets this budget passed in June, and the legislature goes home. He calls him back into special session, and he says, we still have a transportation problem. I mean, gridlock in the Seattle-Tacoma area was a huge issue. He said, I want to raise the gas tax by a nickel and devote it to specific transportation projects. We're going to outline exactly what they are, and it'll last for 30 years to pay for these projects. The legislature passed it, and the Howard Jarvis of Washington State said immediately, we're going to collect signatures, put it at referendum on the ballot to repeal it. And he couldn't get enough signatures. So I would say that the political climate changed rather dramatically in Governor Locke's favor. Now let me talk about Warner, and then I'll come back to Schwarzenegger. Warner in Virginia he had a horrendous situation, just like every other state. He spent 3 years cutting spending, downsizing his bureaucracy, pushing reforms, being a very, very aggressive reinventor and downsizer. And then finally, he turned around and said, you know, we need some tax revenue because we can't cut any further. And the statement was so true and so obvious to so many citizens that the moderate Republicans in the legislature agreed with him, and it passed. So I think it proves that he demonstrated the kind of leadership that people are expecting. And the lessons I just read, I got an email this morning, which outlined a speech he just gave at the DLC in Washington, and one of his lessons was, you know, you can't do tax increases unless you've already proven that you can cut spending and you're going to make tough choices. And the minute you raise the taxes, you've got to go back and do more of the spending cuts and the efficiency and the tough choices. So the lesson was very clear to him. Governor Schwarzenegger, he's very popular now, but, you know, George Bush was very popular on the day he invaded Iraq. And ultimately, the question is, what's the outcome of a leader's decisions? It takes a few years before you know the answer. But in the latest poll, 54% of Americans said invading Iraq was a mistake and it made the world a more dangerous place. And they're right. And President Bush is in deep trouble, and I think he's going to lose this election. So Arnold Schwarzenegger has put together a budget that, as our moderator said, is full of deadly deceptions. It just puts off a lot of the problem. And it's going to come back to haunt him. He's clearly making a bet that in 2 or 3 years, the economy will generate enough revenue that he'll be out of this crisis. I talked to people Wednesday in the state treasurer's office who say, no way will that ever happen. And speculate that he'll resign. He'll serve 2 years and resign, because what else could he be thinking? So I think we have to wait a couple of years before we know whether Arnold Schwarzenegger is a popular governor.
Okay. You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is David Osborne, senior partner of the Public Strategies Group, former advisor to Vice President Al Gore, and co-author of Reinventing Government and the Price of Government. So now let's move to questions in specific policy areas. You've said today that healthcare is the gazillion-pound gorilla. Are there any plans out there? And the questioner specifically asked about Dick Gephardt's plan that would for universal health care that would solve the problem.
Well, I don't think they would solve the fiscal problem. You know, health care is unlike every other industry. In any other industry, you make a product or a service, and new technology allows you to raise the quality and lower the cost. And when the product wears out, we throw it away. And what's different about healthcare is we don't throw people away. We get new technology, and what it does is keep people alive. And so they live longer, and they get old. And when they get old, we spend an enormous amount on them. So in healthcare, technology drives costs up. We have the greatest medical technology in the world, and we spend the highest percentage of our gross domestic product in the world on healthcare, 15% now. And, you know, our healthcare system is highly inefficient, but if we go to universal healthcare, even if we reform the system, it's still going to cost money, and it's still going to go up 10% a year. Or 8% a year, or if we're really good, 6% a year, which means we still have a problem. I mean, I look at the numbers, and I cannot see how we avoid a fundamental choice in this country about 10 years from now. Do we gut Medicare? Do we gut health insurance for the elderly? Or do we raise taxes significantly at the federal level? I can't see how we avoid that choice, personally, regardless of what reforms we institute, and we need to institute lots and lots of reforms of Medicare and Medicaid and the private health market. I mean, it's desperately needed, but it's not going to make this gorilla go away. It's just going to put off the doomsday a little longer.
Okay. The next question asks you to comment on the future for education at the state and local level. Are there any solutions out there for dealing with the rising cost of, let's say, K-12 and then higher education in states?
I think there are. You know, I think the standards-based movement, there's a kernel of truth in it, but it's very misguided, and it's led to a very bureaucratic approach to trying to drive improvement in education and a very expensive approach. I am a fan of using competition to drive excellence and efficiency in education. Now, the way you'd get the most competitive market is with a voucher, but I'm against vouchers. And the reason is because part of what we want from education is equal opportunity. I mean, public education is so important because it gives kids from every walk of life an opportunity to get into the middle class. And it allows us, at least to some degree, to have our children rub elbows with kids from different walks of life, with different skin color, who talk different, and understand something that's fundamental to understand in a multiracial democracy, which is that underneath our skin, we're all the same kind of human beings. If we go to vouchers, we lose all of that, because what happens in a voucher system is, say the voucher's worth $8,000 for high school. Well, if you're poor or working class, you send your kid to an $8,000 high school. If you're, you know, a little more affluent, you maybe can afford a $12,000 high school. You add $4,000 of your own money to the voucher. If you're upper middle class, maybe it's a $16,000 high school. If the sky's the limit, maybe it's a $20,000 or $25,000 high school. And we stratify the education market by income, which I think would be a terrible, terrible mistake. So how do you get competition? It's very simple. You turn public schools into charter schools. The charter school model is the solution here, folks. It's the way we should run public education. Public schools should have a lot of flexibility and a lot of accountability, and they should have to compete for their money and their students. If you run a charter school, you get to focus on what you want to focus on. You get to manage the place the way you want to manage it, but every 5 years, or 4 years, depending on the state, your charter comes up for renewal. And if you're not producing the results that are in that charter that you've promised, you might get shut down. And if the state is doing its job, you do get shut down. In Massachusetts, where I live, we do shut down charter schools that are not effective. So you have enormous accountability. Now, you get funded per student. So if you attract 100 kids away from other schools, you get the money for those 100 kids, and the schools where they were lose the money. How does that affect the schools that lose the kids? It gives them tremendous, tremendous urgency to figure out why kids are leaving, what parents want, and how they can offer it. And that's what's missing from public education. We know a whole lot about how to run effective schools. There are a ton of wonderful models. But inside each school, there isn't the urgency to overcome all the bureaucratic and political obstacles, like teachers' unions, that stand in the way. But if it's compete or die, you get the urgency, and they figure out how to change, and the unions work with management to make the reforms that are necessary. So I think I was part of a commission that the Education Commission of the States put together a few years ago called the National Commission on Governing America's Schools. And we recommended that states begin to experiment with a model of making, states and districts begin experimenting with a model of making every public school a charter school. And I think that's the way to get both excellence and efficiency.
Okay. A quick question about this process of privatization and deregulation. We've had some experience of that in California in the energy area. and the question, so that there are potential downsides to privatization and competition, and the question is, how do you avoid disasters such as the California energy market?
Well, you don't deregulate in stupid ways. I mean, you know, what the Governor Wilson and the legislature did in California was idiotic, and everybody knew it at the time. And I didn't talk about deregulating business. We have to be very careful. I mean, one of government's fundamental roles is to regulate the marketplace. Markets don't work without regulation. The only markets without regulation are black markets, and they're ruled by violence and power. We need government to regulate markets. Now, we should do it wisely, and it's difficult, and politics gets in the way. But using privatization and competition is not the same as deregulation. There's lots of public services that can benefit from competition. And there's lots of them where private companies, there's no reason not to have private companies compete. There are other public services where there's every reason not to have private companies compete, like police. Who wants a for-profit company running the police department? Nobody. But that doesn't mean you can't use competition. In Los Angeles County, lots of cities contract with the sheriff's department or with a neighboring city to run their police services. And they rebid the contract every 3 or 4 years. And when the academics study it, they find that they're getting more bang for their buck because they use competition.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there's just time for only one last question, so I'll make it a big, long, complex one. A number of questions here wants you to talk about how you bring about cooperation from the various interest groups that, say, could block what Governor Locke tried to do. And they also notice that you didn't mention either, I guess, in your book nor today, whether the Locke administration listened to the citizens of the state of Washington as against the elites. So if you could comment on those two things.
Well, the second part, when we came into the picture in Washington, they had 10 weeks left to develop their budget proposal. And there wasn't time to listen to the citizens. With every place else we've worked with, Azusa and Snohomish County and Spokane, we're building in lots of citizen input, and it's a good idea. But, you know, Gary Locke had been governor for 6 years. He'd been elected twice, and he had a pretty good sense of what the priorities of his citizens were. And frankly, nobody questioned that list of 10. That was not an issue. That was the easiest part of the process. Defining those 10. And he did get business and citizens groups and so on involved in that process a little bit, but there wasn't an active listening thing. What was the first part of the question?
How do you get, say, cooperations from unions and other public employee groups, other folks that could block the types of changes that you're trying to bring about?
Well, with great difficulty. The best way is you force a reform that creates consequences for them. And then they'll play ball. For example, when Mayor Steve Goldsmith in Indianapolis in the early 90s forced most city agencies to compete with private firms through managed competition, the unions were opposed to it. And he had to win that battle politically. He had to be a smart politician. And the way he did it was very clever. He promised to devote all the savings to rebuilding infrastructure in the inner city. So he got the inner city members of the city council on his side. Normally they would ally with labor because they were liberals. But they allied with him, they backed it, he won that. Once the unions had to compete, then it was in their self-interest to win the competition. And they became very cooperative and very innovative. And the head of the local AFSCME, American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees Union, you know, spent years going around the country with Goldsmith and his staff at conferences explaining how it worked and what they did. So first you have to get the special interests into a position where their people have consequences, and then they will make different choices. You change the incentive system. And to do that, you have to use politics and you have to win.
Thank you very much. Our thanks to David Osborne, senior partner of the Public Strategies Group. Former advisor to Vice President Al Gore and co-author of Reinventing Government and the Price of Government for his very good comments today. We would also like to thank our audiences here and on the radio. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 100th and first year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.